It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Sunday, March 15th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and I'd love for you to join the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Join us to chat for free, premium content, updates on the show. You can interact with me all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com, and I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. We are in the home stretch of spring training, less than 2 weeks away before opening day. These are what I call the dog days of spring training. The hitters are ready. The pitchers might still need a tune-up or two, but let's face it, you're tired of the spring. You're tired of games not counting. You're starting to see longer outings by the starters. The rosters are starting to come into form, and the weather's actually getting a little bit nicer. You're having a little bit of that snapshot of spring. You're having those little moments, and you know baseball is here. You're all tired of the long, cold winter. The hot stove is behind you. So we're now in that home stretch. A couple of shows left before the season starts. We're going to be talking about decisions, as decisions are being made. Decisions have yet to come. Not everybody's going to be happy. And one of the beautiful things about the Mets this spring, and I'm knocking on a lot of wood here, is they've been very healthy. There seems to be a bit of a roster crunch where they have more players that could be eligible for certain spots than the spots that they have. That's a rarity. So we'll get into all of that. Carlos Beltran's number 15 will be retired. The Mets went from electing him to the Hall of Fame, their Hall of Fame, to Carlos being elected into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and then have his number retired. I'll talk about that. I think Beltran might go down as one of the more underrated stars in team history. And then this is going to be a big show, and I'll tell you why. It's going to be a two-parter. You're going to be getting a lot of Mets content today because our good friend contributed to the show, puts together incredible prospect lists every year. David Mills will be joining me in the second part of the show in part two. And Dave will be talking about his recent release of the Talking Mets top pitching prospects. He'll tease what's to come out in the next couple of weeks with the top positional prospects. We do this every year. We do a positional one. We do a pitching one. Why not start with the pitching? Because that's been the buzz this entire spring. And away we go. So let's just start out as to where we are here in the spring as the Mets roster is finally becoming a little crystallized. And some moves made earlier today, and I think that the only one that might have been a bit of a surprise, and I'm not totally surprised, but after the three dominant outings we saw this spring, you thought maybe there was an outside chance that it would go down to the wire and that Ryan Lambert would have given the Mets something to think about. Lo and behold, they've sent him down to minor league camp. Lambert will not break camp with the team, but he will obviously be someone to watch in AAA. And later on, when Dave Mills comes on, I'm sure his name will come up and we'll talk more about him. But the Mets have decided to send Ryan Lambert down. There still seems to be a bit with A.J. Ewing, and we expected A.J. Ewing to be sent down. But with A.J. Ewing no longer in big league camp, it comes down to Carson Benj and Mike Tauchman right now. Maybe for that right field spot. Maybe both make it. We'll see. And then the bullpen is really starting to come into form here. You have your core five, Devin Williams, Luke Weaver, Brooks Raley, Luis Garcia. And then it's going to be down to with the six-man rotation, assuming there's no injuries. And the only wild card here might be Sean Manaea and Sean Manaea's health that has come into question. We talked about that over at Extra Innings late last week, actually. But let's assume all six starters come north. That leaves seven relievers. That leaves the core five. And that leaves two more, two out of three with Brazenbaum, Hudson, Tobias Myers. He's probably in the top five, I would say. I should say Myers is the five. But Brazenbaum, Hudson, Craig Kimbrell, all vying. Those three are vying for two spots. So it'll be interesting. Everything is starting to come into vision here for the Mets, and there's going to be tough decisions. And I think that's where we'll go, because a lot of what I see this afternoon after the Lambert news came down, and then obviously the discussion about Benj has been all over social media for a while. And fans naturally love homegrown players. They love homegrown players who are top prospects, homegrown players who are top 100 prospects. And naturally, they want Benj to make the team. It's always the new shiny object that gets, I guess, some of the love of the fan base. But I think if you look at what the Mets did here with Lambert, how they sent Lambert down, they wanted to see him. From some of the scuttlebutt out there, I don't think it was that easy of a decision, but they wanted to see what this kid has, give him some time down in AAA. Probably also plays into the fact that with the bullpen right now, outside of Myers and Brazenbaum, you don't have any players with options. So, you know, you're going to lose somebody if you put Lambert into the mix. You'd have to either send Brazenbaum down, Myers down, who's had a good spring and is probably going to be your bulk reliever out of the pen, a position that nobody else really could hold. So what you learned here, and I think you have to take that, what Stearns is going to do with this team in general. And I think, be prepared, I guess my message is, to be disappointed with Carson Benj. Because I look at this as, all winter, Stearns has said Benj has a chance to win the job. And that's been true. He hasn't lied to us. Benj is here. We're in the last week and a half of camp. He's still competing for a spot. He's had a nice spring. He's getting pushed by Mike Tauchman, who's also had a very good spring. We've talked about Tauchman here since he came back from Korea. The second act of his career is a good left-handed hitter, hits both lefties and righties, decent enough outfielder, veteran, somebody that could probably hit 10 to 15 home runs, drive 50 to 70 runs in some kind of outfield play. Maybe he gets 350 to 400 at-bats. Maybe Taylor spots him against some tough lefties or, you know, when he's at a slump. When you start to look at that, when you see what Tauchman can provide, there's enough of a floor here that allows you to have the ability to send Benj down to AAA and prove that he's for real at the big league level. Now, I know what everyone's going to say. Hey, he's had a great spring. What does he need to prove? Let's keep in mind that Benj was drafted less than 2 years ago. He had some struggles in AAA. He came into spring with some expectations, and there's been a wide range of projections, and we've talked about this a lot this spring. You have the wild best-case scenario that he's another Kyle Tucker. If only we could hope. You have some others that have put him as a floor, maybe a Steve Finley type of hitter. Maybe he falls into that very good all-star Nick Markakis, someone who hits 15 to 20 home runs, drives in about 80, 85 runs, hits 290 to 300, great arm, good defense in the outfield, would be a nice lane for him to land in. All of those things, he could be any of those guys, all of that could wait. And I know what everybody's going to say. You're going to say, well, what about Pete Alonso? What about the message that it sends that the guy comes in and plays well but doesn't earn the spot? There's a big difference, I would say, with these a couple of things. Mets are in a way different position right now than they were in 2019. 2019, they were coming off a couple of very disappointing seasons, an ownership group that was not inspiring confidence. Alonso was already dominating AAA, albeit it was in Vegas. He had already shown that he could hit AAA pitching. There was questions about how good he would be as a big leaguer. I remember those conversations very, very, very vividly. I remember all of them. A lot of people weren't sure that he was for real. They didn't show, you know, there was, to this day, we still talk about the questions about him defensively. But he came into camp. He ripped the job away from everybody. Nobody came close. There was no Mike Tauchman playing first base that were pushing Alonso. And quite honestly, there was even talk back then that from a financial perspective, they should send him down for at least 2 weeks to gain an extra year control. That extra year that they wound up not taking advantage of cost Steve Cohen $30 million because they had to re-sign him last year. That would have been his year that he could have been under control, you know, with the organization. But I think that Benj is a little bit different in the sense where, yeah, you could talk about the control and the monetary situation with Benj, but Benj has not played a full season of AAA and performed like even Alonso did. He struggled, actually, in his brief appearance at AAA. And I'm not saying he has to spend a lot of time down there, because let's face it, AAA has become kind of this weird level of never will be's, 4A, disgruntled veterans hanging on and things like that. And as an organization, you have to watch how many of these veterans that you litter your roster with that could poison some of the up-and-coming promising prospects. There is no harm in Bench going down for a month and the Mets starting the season with Mike Talkman in the outfield. There really isn't. And if you look at that, and I'm looking at the roster right now, you send Bench down, you put Talkman in as your, you know, you're going to have to make a roster move. You put Talkman in as your starting right fielder. You have Torrens and Taylor as the backup. You have Vientos. And then let's face it, you know, Beatty's going to maybe, right now you looked at Beatty play a nice first base today. I'm not at all sure that Beatty, when the year is out, won't be pushing to be the starting first baseman, maybe push Polanco to the DH spot. And then that puts you with Mark Vientos maybe spotting Beatty at first base a little bit. I know there's some questions about Vientos. And maybe bringing either Arroyo or Brujan north as that utility infielder off the bench. You send Mauricio down to get seasoning and play every day. It's a bit of a more complete roster out of spring. And then you get a chance for Bench to see, you know, to show that he really is the real deal. If Bench is hitting 400 and tearing the cover off the ball, and all your talent evaluators come to Stearns, you know, let's say the 15th to 20th of April, and say, look, he's wasting his time down here. Talkman's off to a buck 80 start, or, you know, you're not really seeing a need for Arroyo Brujan as your middle infield depth. Then maybe gets called up sooner rather than later. And yeah, the byproduct of that is you save some time in terms of, you know, service time. Let's also remember, I know they've been working on a Luis Robert Jr. There's a guy with a history of injuries. And the likelihood, I mean, I know the Mets are working on it, the likelihood that he'll stay healthy and not need a stint on the injured list is probably slim. I would say it's more likely that Bench gets called up because of a Robert Jr. injury than it is that Talkman's going to turn into a pumpkin and not hit. I mean, he's hit now, played on both north and south side of Chicago, and he hit pretty well both stops. And the Cubs were a team that was in contention. It's not like he was playing for a second division club like the White Sox the whole time there. So I know that's not a popular opinion. I've always been one to say you have to send the message of earning a spot. And I think that at the time when Alonso was coming up the ranks, there was a lot more, and it was still fresh on everybody's head what the Cubs did to Chris Bryant a few years earlier when he had a big spring, and then they didn't bring him up till May to save a year of service time. Service time manipulation right now is something definitely that would come up as a huge red flag with the CBA negotiations. I really don't see this as the same situation, because although Bench has had a nice spring and he's shown some real promise, he's had some real good at-bats, I can't sit here and say that he's without a doubt proven that he's the everyday right fielder. And with the now, if Talkman was hitting above 50 and showing age or decline, that'd be a different ballgame. None of that's happening. So my prediction is, and a lot of this goes back to how they handled Ryan Lambert, and I know it's not totally apples to apples here, but the Mets are going to go a little slower with their young players. They're going to let them ease into the big league roster. They have enough talent at the big league roster where they don't have to rush anybody. Nobody wants to be a savior. And I may be dating myself here, but what it reminds me a little bit is a decision back in the day the Mets didn't make that potentially harmed. And I don't really think this is a correlation, but it goes to show you, the story I'm about to tell you goes to show you how when you don't handle a player properly when it comes to their big league ascension into the big leagues, you could harm them for the foreseeable future. Now, back in the late 80s, everybody might know this story. Greg Jeffries gets brought up late 1988, hits like a gangbuster, has a couple of big hits in the postseason, and basically rips the starting second base job away from two popular veterans, Wally Backman and Tim Tuffle. They actually traded Wally Backman that offseason to Minnesota to make room for Jeffries. And going into 89, he's the starting second baseman, and he gets off to a really bad start to the point where there were calls of maybe the Mets should send him down and let him just clear his head. And there was a lot of clubhouse issues with Jeffries and all that other stuff. A lot of expectations. I mean, Jeffries was a top prospect in baseball. Bat, swinging the bat underwater, all sorts of things. Look it up. It's an interesting story if you want to look it up. It's probably still out there. But and now he wound up rebounding and having a decent offensive season the rest of the year into 1990. But he never really hit his stride until he left New York. Now, maybe that had to do with New York and the time and his age and all sorts of things. But I think if they had sent Jeffries down to reboot a little bit, who knows what could have happened there? Who knows how that could have helped him? Now, I'm not saying Benj is in the same spot, but rushing a player and throwing him into the lineup. Let's say Benj makes the team. You hand him the everyday right field job, and he's hitting 180 and striking out and showing some developmental opportunities there early in the season and has to get sent down. I'm not saying he's a guy that's is going to be crushed and never recover from that. There's a value to that failure at the big league level. But why put him in that spot? Why put that target on his back? Why do that to the team that's competing and trying to win a championship? That's the goal here. These guys are talking the talk. They're playing for a lot here. This is, you know, the manager is a lame duck right now. The team is coming off a disappointing season. They have two top 10 positional players, one smack in their prime, one in the late prime, that do not want to be in any kind of learning curve when it comes to the team winning. They have young pitchers that are burgeoning. They want to win. And I'm not saying that Benj can't be part of that. What I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be, he doesn't have to be forced onto this roster. And I think the best decision and the decision I predict that will happen is he will be sent down. It will cause a ruckus. He will go down. He will play well. He will hit. And he'll be up sooner rather than later, whether it be for a Robert Jr. injury, whether it be to find a spot for him on the roster. Heck, you know, maybe he's hitting so well and they're so confident in him that they trade Talkman at some point and get something for him to make room on the roster. I also think it's not a bad idea with Lindor, who looked good. Look, Lindor's come back quicker than anybody could think, who looked good today and looks like he's checking all the boxes to make it for opening day. It wouldn't be the worst thing to have a middle infielder that could spot him and give him some blows in a blowout game or even a day game after a night game. Make the guy DH or something. Right now, unless you want to move Bo Bichette over to shortstop, I haven't really heard much talk about them doing that. And with him learning a position, I'm not so sure that's the smartest thing to do. I think you want to keep him at third base, keep him getting those reps. I think the days of shortstop are long past Marcus Semien. Polanco never was a good infielder, and you're not going to want to throw him in there. The Mets have talked about run prevention, and I think when they talk about run prevention, they're specifically talking about up the middle defense. So, you know, it would make sense to bring a Brujan or somebody like that, or a Arroyo or somebody like that with the team north and give them that utility guy that could come in, maybe pinch run, certain things. So that's my prediction of how it will go with the positional players. I think the other thing that a lot of fans are going to bring up is why bring Vientos north? I talked about this on one of the extra innings. I think I'm as sick as you are about the Vientos hits the ball hard. That narrative is getting old. At some point, you can hit the ball a million miles an hour. An out is an out. A line out is a line out. A fly ball is a fly ball. A weak ground ball is a weak ground ball. They're all outs in the box score, and they're all zeros on the batting average. So I understand that. With that said, if you designate Vientos for assignment, he will be picked up in 30 seconds. And very well, he might go to a sanitized environment, a non-winning environment, like a Colorado or something like that, and maybe put up 30 and 90 and make you regret that you didn't give him a chance to play every day. That could likely happen. I think that he is a bit of a clumsy fit on this roster. It's a conversation that we've had on this show that at some point between Mauricio, Beatty, Vientos, and with Jacob Reimer now coming, you have a bit of a roster crunch there. Vientos, outside of his OMG summer, has had negative value on this team. The stats are the stats. I've seen that. I've talked about that. But he still is a bat that has shown that he could hit big in a big spot. He has 25 to 30 home run power. When he gets hot, he's streaky as hell. When he gets hot, he can tear the cover off the ball. And he could be a really good, valuable hitter down the lineup. I think as a seventh hitter on a good team like the Mets, there's some value. I know that playing against lefties, playing a couple of times a week, which looks like that's going to be the situation for Vientos, is not necessarily going to get him the development that he needs. Ultimately, it reminds me, and I talked about this on Extra Innings, a little bit of like J.D. Davis, when J.D. Davis was at this club and really didn't grab a spot, how he never really was able to find his way. They wound up trading him, selling him low, really, when you think about it, in the Darren Ruff deal. I think you would be selling Vientos even lower if you dealt him now, unless somebody gave you some kind of high upside pitcher or prospect or something along those lines at the end of spring training. I see no indication, especially the way Mendoza's talking about Vientos, that they're going to move on from Vientos. And why do you have to, just to force Benj on the roster for opening day? Like, it is a long season. Whether Benj is on the roster on March 26th, April 15th, May 1st, June 1st, whatever, he'll be on the roster eventually. If he is who we think he is, if he is who the scouts say he's going to be, he'll be on the roster. And when our friend David Mills comes on in part two, he's going to tell you why he doesn't even think Benj is the best positional player in the organization. I'm going to tease that a little bit for you guys. So this might be one of those shows where I get all the nasty emails and things like that. Now, as far as the pitching side, I mentioned the top five. Williams, Weaver, Raley, Garcia, Myers made it. I'm assuming that Manaea is not headed for some kind of IL stint or extended spring. It's possible, and I said this in Extra Innings, and I'll say it again, it's possible that with some of the days off, I think the Mets have about 3 or 4 days off, to start the season, that you could still get the mechanics of a six-man rotation, not having six starters. Maybe you leave Manaea behind to get his velocity up. Only the Mets know on the back end what's going on. That would allow you to bring Brazenbaum north. That would allow you to bring Hudson north. And that would allow you to bring Kimbrel north and maybe get a little bit more of a look the first month of the season to see what you have there. Eventually, you're going to have to make a decision and you're going to have to expose somebody to waivers if it's not a Brazenbaum with options or Myers with options. And it's possible you lose yourself a good arm. I think until Minter is available May 1st-ish, that it would behoove the Mets to bring two lefties up. Raley is not your typical lefty. He could get both sides out. But somebody who could get a tough lefty out, especially in a division where you have Olsen, you have Harper, you have Schwarber. I'm not looking at the schedule right now. I know that it's not like the old days where you play the NL East early, but it can't hurt knowing that throughout the year you're going to possibly need some lefties to come in and get some big outs against some of those big lefty bats that you're going to face in the division. So I see it going down that route. If Manaea is part of the team from day one, I think it's going to be Kimbrel and Hudson. I think Brazenbaum and his options gets him sent down. I know he's been playing in the WBC and he's been pitching well. And that's really where it goes down to. And then at that point, it's ready to strap it on and see what this team's got and begin what we call the getting to know you phase right here. So decisions, not easy decisions. And I think the point I'm here to make is just because there are players that start the season on the roster doesn't mean they'll end the season on the roster. Opening day is just a ceremonial day. It doesn't mean that you're married to the roster for the rest of the year. You're not even married to the roster for more than that one game. So really, I think we make a bigger deal about the opening day roster than it has to be made. I know it'd be cool to see Benj make it. I know as a top prospect, fans love homegrown players. But I think that Stearns is going to play the long game, and I don't think Benj is going to make the team. I think Talkman's going to make the team. I think one of the middle infielders is going to make the team off the bench, and I think it'll be interesting to see how they go with the bullpen. And I think there's a lot of information, particularly on the bullpen guys, and even Benj, from the back end, from the analytics side, from what they see from a scouting side that we're not privy to, that is going to go into play and be the deciding factor as to who comes north with this club, in less than 2 weeks, in about a week and a half. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Carlos Beltran. His number is going to be retired. His number 15 is going to be retired by the Mets. He's in the Hall of Fame. There was some debate about this, which is funny. I'm going to tell you why Beltran might be one of the most underrated players in the history of the team right after this.
16th inning, 2-2 to Beltran. Ripped in the air to deep right field. Abreu looks up, and we're going home. Beltran with a home run. Wins it for the Mets in the bottom of the 16th inning. At 12:33 a.m., Carlos Beltran ends the Mets' longest game in 11 years with a walk-off home run, his 12th of the year. And you betcha they're happy.
All right, we're back. So wanted to get to the Carlos Beltran conversation before we take a little detour in part two and talk about our Talking Mets top pitching prospects, and then tease the top positional prospects with our good buddy, contributor David Mills. David is a guy that has been helping the show since its last 2 or 3 years, since we brought on Extra Innings, Beyond the Mic, the premium content. David has been a part of that, and what he's been doing is using some of his experience in baseball training, the experience he has understanding how development in the big leagues works, his contacts that he has throughout the sport. He's got a much more nuanced understanding of player development than someone like a talk show host like I has. And I think nothing against the other lists that are out there. You know, there's all great lists. You know, I have a good friend, Ernie Dove, and our buddy Joe DiMeo over at SMY. I mean, I've known Joe for 22 decades. I know Joe when he was a kid, and we met on AOL Instant Messenger in a Mets group. I mean, think about how long it's been since I've known Joe DiMeo, from the days when you got a lot of your content on message groups and, you know, forums and things like that, you know, just talking Mets baseball. But I think David's work stands out, and it's probably that, and if you haven't had a chance, it's free for all. It's over at Extra Innings. That was some of the best, most detailed work on Mets pitching prospects that are out there, and we'll talk with him about that. And he is going to surprise you with one of the arms that he's very, very excited about. I think you'll be surprised about that. I also think you're going to be surprised that he's going to tell you why Carson Benj is not the top positional prospect in the organization. But before we get to that, let's get to Carlos Beltran. So Carlos Beltran's number is going to be retired by the Mets. I believe it's later this summer. And I think it's well-deserved. And I know there's been some debate, and I'm not going to get into it today, but there was debate about Gary Carter and whether Gary Carter should be retired, and John Franco, Jacob DeGrom's name has come up. There's all sorts of conversations about that. I think retired numbers are for those that have left footprints and left an impact. And the fact that a lot of fans, and maybe they didn't get to see Beltran at the height of his career, maybe it's the younger fans, although it's amazing to me, Beltran was at the height of his career 2 decades ago, 20 years ago. It doesn't seem that long ago, but I understand that that's generationally. Some people are 22, 23, 24, 25. They didn't see Beltran play. I have to remember that. But when you look at, and just use Baseball Reference, top positional players in the franchise's history, and you just use wins above replacement, we'll do something very, very simple, a number that encompasses offense and defense and value to a player. The top three players in this franchise's history are David Wright, by a large margin, Daryl Strawberry, and Carlos Beltran. And Carlos Beltran is about 5 win shares behind Strawberry. And I would dare say, if Beltran didn't have a knee injury, and maybe he had a little bit better inaugural year when he got the collision with Mike Cameron, he'd be right there with Strawberry, probably surpassed him at this point. Now, when I look at the best 3-year period, and I know this is debatable because those three players had really good careers, but they had peaks and valleys for different reasons. Each had some valleys, mainly because of either injuries or off-the-field stuff or things like that. The 3-year period I used to compare, and I will dare say that Beltran's 3-year period from 06 to 08 arguably may be the best both sides of the ball period for any positional player in team history. And I'll repeat that. Carlos Beltran from 2006 to 2008 might be the best both sides of the ball period for a positional player in team history. Now, the David Wright fans are going to argue David Wright. Hey, David Wright, here's a guy that won a couple of gold gloves during that period. And, you know, it's close, no doubt about it. It's definitely close. But I will say this. Beltran played a premium position. He played it at an elite level. He won a couple of gold gloves. He finished top 4 in an MVP one of those years, as did Wright one of those years. In 07, he did. He undoubtedly was the crown jewel of a free agent signing that brought, I guess, the Wright-Reyes era and elevated to another level. I think Wright and Reyes had some learning curve. I think Beltran coming in was the star they needed to be the constellation around him. And I think eventually, obviously, Wright was right there with him. And then there's Strawberry. And I think Strawberry is kind of a conflicting one because from a standpoint of standing in the game and from a news standpoint, Strawberry's offensive numbers are better than actually Beltran's. If you look at Strawberry in 87 and 88, I went 86 to 88. Strawberry had a down 89 and he had a really good 90 and he was hurt in 85. So he had a couple of breakage in his periods. But, you know, if you look at 87, 88, 90, and 87 by far, the year after the Mets won the World Series, was a huge, was probably Strawberry's best offensive year. I mean, he hit for average, hit for power, drove in runs. The only thing that I guess Strawberry didn't have, he finished, I think he finished sixth in the MVP that year. Now, he finished second in 88. That's the year he hit 39 home runs and drove 101 runs. The only thing I guess that Strawberry doesn't have compared to Beltran is the glove. And he wasn't a bad glove, but he wasn't a great one. I think he was an okay outfielder, good arm. I think some of Strawberry's issues in the field were probably focused. Probably some of those off-the-field issues were playing into it. You can't really argue that, and I guess that's what I was going to say. It's hard to argue that one is better than the other. If you want to say it's Wright, I can't say you're wrong. If you want to say it's Strawberry, I can't say it's wrong. If you want to say it's Beltran, you can't say it's wrong. You really can't. And when you look at that, when you start to have Beltran in the conversation with those two great Mets, both of who had their numbers retired, well, this makes a ton of sense. And the real Greek tragedy of Beltran, and you know, the amazing part is the top three offensive players in Mets history actually are almost a Greek tragedy because each one had something happen to them that derailed what could have been a very good all-star Mets Hall of Fame career into, well, Beltran is a Hall of Famer. And let's put it that way. Out of the three, he's the Hall of Famer. Now, he did a lot of stuff before and after his Mets years. But, I mean, Strawberry easily could have been a Hall of Famer if he had stayed on the straight and narrow. And he's even said by leaving New York, that probably exacerbated some of his problems. Wright, tragic injury. There's a guy that was Eddie Matthews, Mike Schmidt, Chipper Jones. He's probably, not probably, he's in the Hall of Fame. And let me tell you, he might have only retired 4 or 5 years ago if he had stayed healthy. I mean, his contract was out in 2018. If he had still been, he was still in his 30s at that point, he might have had another 2 or 3 years. You know, we might be saying David Wright as a recent retiree in the last 3 or 4 years. I know that's probably really, really late in his career and he might be a bench player, but, you know, think about that, right? We got robbed of a lot of Wright in his late prime to after prime at that point. So I don't see why Beltran, I think his Greek tragedy is the knee injury. We don't know how that would have, that microfracture injury. We don't know how that would have played if his knee had stayed healthy. He probably would have had definitely a better 09 and 10, and he wouldn't be robbed of a couple of years. He came back in 11 and was really good until they traded him to the Giants, and then he went on to not be the elite center fielder. Post-knee, wasn't an elite defensive center fielder anymore. He was still a very good hitter, but he was more of a corner outfielder, DH type at that point. I think Beltran's career is marred by the strikeout, the Hall of Fame curveball strikeout by Wainwright. I've said it time and time again, if you watch that at bat, and I have, and it's a very painful watch, that the taking that initial fastball was probably where he made the mistake. Wainwright was scared blank on the mound. He's admitted that years later. He just wanted to get one over. That's the pitch you drive, and he drives it into the gap. The Mets win the ball game. They go to the World Series, and I mean, there's always the feeling that the Mets would have steamrolled the Tigers. You just never know. Momentum certainly would have been in their favor, but Beltran gets canonized for a Game 7 hit, and I think there's no question that he's a Hall of Fame material. No question at that point. I think the failures of 06, 07, 08 Mets that really, I think, sent this organization into that negative yoke, that spiral that I think they're starting to come out from, with Lindor and OMG and everything, what we talked about, I think that period really cemented the yoke on their back, the LOL Mets, the Mets can never win, they're cursed. because up until that point, there was disappointments, no doubt about it. But it was that 06 to 08 when it looked like they were there and they had everything in their favor, and the way they lost in 07 and to a lesser degree 08 that exacerbated this narrative. And with Beltran being tied to that, being the best player or the 1 to 1-8 or right best player on that team, and with that strikeout, I think he gets connected to that. I think that's unfair. So I think the point is Beltran is a fabulous Hall of Fame candidate. He should have been in on the first ballot. The sign-stealing thing was complete horse blank. Maybe in the long run, the Mets, I wasn't sure he was the right managerial fit. He had some interesting traits. I thought him as a coach, him as an executive, the experiences he's had growing up, English as a second language, working his way through the league as a young player, seeing success, living up to a big contract, coming back from an injury, a serious injury, to be a veteran on the other side, and then being that sage veteran in a clubhouse at the end, mentoring young players. He was every version of a ball player at the peak that really you would want to pick his brain. I mean, how many players can say they went through all those different versions that are pretty much the stereotypical type of player that, you know, you would want to go to and say, hey, I'm a young player who doesn't speak the language well. I'm struggling. I don't know if this is for me. Well, that was Beltran. Hey, I'm Juan Soto. I signed a big contract. And I'm not dealing with the pressure well. That was Beltran. Hey, I'm coming back from a serious injury, and I'm not sure I'm the same player. Talk to me about how you handled it. That's Beltran. Hey, I'm at the end of my career. I could contribute, but I'm not a star anymore. I'm a component player or a role player or a secondary, tertiary part of the team. How do I deal with that? And how do I provide value to the team? That was Beltran at the end of his career in Houston. So, look, that is to me why I think Beltran's one of the more fascinating guys that has donned the Mets uniform. I think he arguably might be the best player on both sides of the ball in team history, not taking anything away from David Wright. Again, you could argue, hey, Wright, Beltran, Strawberry, you really can't be wrong. But I think if you are shortchanging Beltran by not putting Beltran in there, right? Beltran, you know, Strawberry, if you're not giving Beltran his due, I think you're mistaken. I think you're underrating him. And I think a lot of fans underrate him. A lot of pundits and media types underrate him. I think he gets bashed way too much. There's a certain former WFAN host that made a career complaining about Beltran not being clutch, and that's unfair. So anyway, a little detour before part two. Let's wrap up here and stay tuned. Part two will be released shortly. My conversation about the top 10 Mets positional, pitching prospects, and teasing the top positional prospects with our good buddy, contributor David Mills. We'll be back with part two right after this.